Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to the 9th series of Reading Our Times. In this series, we're navigating our way through a world of confusing and often contentious ideas, equipped only with big books, serious authors, and time to think. We're going to be talking about slavery and reparations, wokery and left-wing politics, poetry and our sense of the sacred. We're going to talk about the origins of the West, what's behind the assisted dying debate, about the way the Enlightenment has been co-opted into the culture wars, about how our evolutionary past continues to shape our political present, and in a live recording at the How the Light Gets In Festival in London, I'll be talking to critics and publishers about books and the future of civilization. And underneath it all, of course, lies the question to which Reading Our Times always gravitates. What does all this say about the human condition? A few years ago, I engaged in debate with Professor Steven Pinker about his book Enlightenment Now. The book argued that life, for most people today, is better than it has been at any time in the past. Being a glass-half-empty kind of a person, I wasn't inclined to believe this, but Pinker marshalled an awful lot of evidence in support of his case, and I was more impressed by the book than I thought I was going to be, or at least by the first three quarters of the book, because the last quarter tried to explain why we had seen this improvement. And here, Pinker moved away from data and graphs and argued that all of this could be explained by a newfound commitment to science, reason, humanism, and progress, all of which developed in something called the Enlightenment. If you want a reason why things are better today, you'll find it in the Enlightenment, and a definite article there is important. To be honest, I thought this was a remarkably thin, patchy, vague, ahistorical, self-serving and uninquisitive understanding of a period of intellectual and social history. Pinker's book may have been particularly egregious in this, but it's hardly alone. The Enlightenment has been a familiar trope for a while now, though quite how long is something we'll discuss in this episode. Moreover, increasingly, it's an idea that's being recruited into the culture wars. The Enlightenment is under threat, wrote Richard Dawkins a few years ago, though the sentiment could have come from any number of people. The Enlightenment needs to be rescued, protected, preserved from, well, take your pick, post-modernity, nationalists, populists, religion, faith. The Enlightenment is not just a thing of the past here. On the contrary, it's a thing of the present. And it's a thing, to quote the title of a book on the subject, that still matters. But is it actually a thing? Was it even a thing in the first place? What is or was the Enlightenment? What are we being called to defend here? Indeed, would anyone who lived during the Enlightenment even recognise what we are talking about in all this? Jonathan Clark is a historian who has held posts at Cambridge, Oxford, Chicago, and Kansas. He's written extensively on intellectual history, philosophy, social history, literature, and historiography, especially in the so-called long 18th century, between 1660 and 1832. His latest book, The Enlightenment, An Idea and Its History, explores what and whether the Enlightenment actually was. I spoke to him from his book line study in a conversation that was punctuated by the beautiful chimes of a clock. Jonathan, welcome to Reading Our Times.
Thank you so much.
I'd like to begin near the end and look at the way in which we talk about the Enlightenment today. You write early on in the book that your objective is to historicise some of the explanatory concepts that have been put to anachronistic and polemical uses in recent decades. Can you describe some of those anachronistic and polemical ways that we talk about the Enlightenment today?
Certainly. I've been thinking about these uses, and there are a number of such uses, but one has come to stand out in my mind, and you've drawn my attention to a number of contemporary thinkers who have achieved great prominence And I have to ask myself, what are the main intellectual premises of what are currently regarded as progressive politics? And I find that these premises are shared by authors like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Anthony Pagden, Steven Pinker. So can I just talk very briefly about these figures?
Absolutely.
Richard Dawkins needs no introduction. Perhaps his most famous book was The God Delusion. But, of course, Richard Dawkins is a geneticist, and he doesn't write in that book about the Enlightenment. He doesn't give an historical account of the Enlightenment. He takes it for granted. He mentions Voltaire and Paine briefly, but they didn't go far enough, according to Dawkins, because they were both deists, he says, and not atheists, and he wants the Enlightenment to be a secular phenomenon. And so elsewhere, instead of giving an historical account of the Enlightenment, he merely picks up the term and uses it, as he did in 2006 when he wrote that the Enlightenment is under threat. Why under threat? Because of what he saw as the rise of Protestant fundamentalism in US politics at that time. And his major premise then was that the United States was founded as a secular enterprise. Now, he's not an historian, and I would submit that no historian would say that now. It was the opposite of being a secular enterprise, but that's not what he wants it to be. Or if we take Christopher Hitchens, who published a book entitled God is Not Great, it ends with a chapter entitled The Need for a New Enlightenment. And why? Because he phrased it as a defense of what he called modernity and technology against what he called faith-based fanatics. So we need a new enlightenment to defend us against these faith-based fanatics. And that's a theme running through his book. And similarly, Anthony Pagden, in his very able book, The Enlightenment and Why It Still Matters, defines himself on the front page of that book, page one, against what he calls fundamentalist religious beliefs. And he goes on to praise the cosmopolitanism of the Enlightenment and to identify its social constituency as what he calls the new middle class, well-off, educated, and literate. I think it's hard to escape the conclusion that such writers are projecting onto the canvas of history their own values and their own practices from their own corner of the world. So what these authors, I think, are doing is to reach back into the past to pick up on something which they and others define as the Enlightenment in order to derive confirmation and authority for their views. Yes. And my question is, was the 18th century Enlightenment really like that? Can it provide endorsement and authority for their views? Or do their views, they're perfectly entitled to their views, do their views stand on their own merits?
Mm. So let's delve back into the 18th century then. You say right at the beginning, the Enlightenment was not a precocious and international reality, but a recent term of historiographical art. And we're going to come on later in our conversation about how recent. It's important to emphasize that you don't deny the realities of expanding literacy, spreading debate, scientific discovery, and all that from the 18th century.
No, I accept these things. And that's what makes it even more remarkable that despite all these important developments, the Enlightenment was not conceptualized in the 18th century.
So that's critical. The fact is that these things are going on.
Yes.
People recognize they're going on, but they're not labeled as a singular identifiable movement. You write, this is a very important point, you say it at the beginning of the book and several times throughout, in the long 18th century, Enlightenment was everywhere, but the Enlightenment was nowhere. Unpack that for us.
Well, what do people mean by Enlightenment? Where do we start from? We start from the most obvious text, which everybody has in the English-speaking world in the 18th century, and that's the Bible. And there are many, many, many usages of light in the Bible as a metaphor for spiritual truth. But the meaning is practical also, so that people talk about enlightening when they're talking about the spread of streetlights in cities. You can enlighten Grosvenor Square by putting up streetlights all around it. So it's practical as well. And from there, the usage spreads, the meaning spread to mean the acquisition of information in general. So that enlightenment means, as a noun, the end state after information has been acquired, after a problem has been solved. And it means the same in German. So Aufklärung means what it means in Freud's book, die Aufklärung der Kinder, which means teaching children the facts of life. It means clearing up and elucidating and informing people. So did people think of themselves as enlightened in the 18th century? Certainly they did. They all did. Just as we now all drive cars and we think of ourselves as good drivers. But my question is, do the insurance companies agree? And I find that they don't. So I'm not so persuaded that they are perfect drivers. And in the 18th century, so many bad things are going on, as well as the good things. Should we be persuaded that all those people have an access to enlightenment as wisdom? Perhaps we should qualify that a bit.
Yes. One of the analyses of the Enlightenment, and you talk about this quite early in the book, is that it was a social practice. Some thinkers, predominantly Jürgen Habermas, have talked about the Enlightenment as a kind of development of a bourgeois public square, English coffee houses, French salons, so on and so forth, where there's an unprecedented opportunity for open, discursive, civil, polite, enlightened conversation. Is that fair?
Well, it's partly true, I think, and you can certainly point to cases where that happened, but you can point to at least as many places and instances where people in coffee houses were impolite. Let's remember that Habermas was a sociologist. He didn't actually know much about history, and his great book on the structural transformation of the public sphere was the sort of book which you would write in a German university if your university library had been bombed in the war, and you're left with two books on English history published about 1890, 1900. So you don't know, but he infers what coffee houses must have stood for and what French salon must have stood for from his Marxism. He said, Marxism produces a stadial theory of historical development. On one stage is the emergence of the public sphere in the coffee house, exemplifying, I'm sorry to use the old cliche, the rise of the middle class. Well, historians don't talk about that now.
So this is another example of back reading, as it were, of having your own particular ideology and finding it, finding evidence for it.
That's right.
Back in the 18th century.
You know what you want to find, so you find it there.
Yeah.
And it's not completely wrong, but it's not sufficiently right to confirm the Marxist stadial scenario.
Hmm. So there's the truth, but not the whole truth in what he's saying.
Yes. You can add other instances of sociability to that. The tavern, the inn. People get drunk in taverns and they talk to each other, sometimes politely, sometimes impolitely. There's one famous illustration of a coffee house in which one customer is throwing a cup of coffee at another customer. They're not being polite. They're arguing. The illustration comes from the moment of the Sir Cheverel controversy in early 18th century England, when Whigs and Tories are at each other's throats on religion and politics. And it probably comes out of that. They're not being polite.
I wonder, they're not being polite by the standards of, say, polite discussion today. They're not being polite by ideal standards, but they would see themselves being polite by comparison with some of the disputes in the 17th century, which were fundamentally very bloody. That's why they saw themselves as enlightened and polite, because they're looking back over their shoulder at a century in which people had been slaughtering one another over differences.
And they go on slaughtering each other all the way through the 18th century, all the way through the 19th, and all the way through the 20th. And as we go into the 21st, they're still doing it. So they're polite in the same sense as we all think we're good drivers, until we have a car crash.
I want to talk about France, because in the popular imagination, if the Enlightenment means anything, it's a French affair. I mean, you mentioned how Dawkins quotes Voltaire. Voltaire is always quoted when people talk about the Enlightenment, less often, but sometimes Diderot is quoted and Baron de Holbach. You point out that the French themselves lacked a term for what was allegedly going on. And B, very importantly, there was a considerable variety of activity, intellectual and social activity, within France at the time, right?
Yes, certainly. I go back to the point that the salon were not precursors of the university seminar table, and they're built up to be that around seminar tables in late 20th century universities, because we all like to reach back into the past to create people or groups who anticipated our own values so that we can depict ourselves as the culmination of a long wave. But it's very far from the truth. There's a very good French historian, Antoine Lilty, who's done much research into activities in salon, and they're by no means what they were built up to be in the late 20th century. France, let's remember, is not a backward society. It's an extremely articulate, literate society in which people talk to each other and are locked in political and theological conflicts all the way through the 18th century. And it's not that the Enlightenment establishes consensus. On the contrary, the more publications you have, the more conversations you have, the more you find you disagree with other Frenchmen.
Is there a centre of gravity in this intellectual movement in France in the 18th century? By which I mean, I understand how many of these thinkers that are subsequently labelled as Enlightenment thinkers coalesce around opposition to the Catholic Church, for example. But also it seems to me that that's fundamentally what they agree on. And when it comes to anything like a positive agenda, there is significant disagreement between these thinkers. Is that right?
Well, with respect, can I beg to differ from how you phrased that question?
Of course.
You say, did the movement in the 18th century have a common theme, a common core? But that begs the question. And I'm saying there wasn't one movement in the 18th century which could have had a common theme. Yes, there were many religious skeptics in 18th century France, and at the end of the century, even a few outright atheists. But whether you put these into the category of the Enlightenment or not determines the outcome. So do you put Rousseau into the category of the Enlightenment? He was a theist. Let's go to England. Do you put Samuel Johnson into the category of the Enlightenment? He was a theist, a militant theist. And if you put people like that into the Enlightenment and take out the atheists, then you have a theist Enlightenment. If you take Johnson and Rousseau out of the category and you put the atheists in, then you have an atheist Enlightenment. But you're not learning anything about 18th century France, and you're not learning anything about how religious skepticism, heterodoxy, or ultimately secularism come to develop. And how, when, and why they develop is a real historical problem.
You're right to pick me up there. I found myself doing this when I was writing the script for our discussion. Indeed, when I was reading the book, I repeatedly found myself referring to the movement or the phenomenon, and then correcting myself in along the lines of the entire book is pointing out that it isn't the movement or isn't the phenomenon. It's just very easy to slip into this terminology that almost seeped into our intellectual bloodstream. So correct me again if I do it again
well,
in our conversation.
I don't want to correct you too loudly, because after all, that's what I thought for decades. I was educated in that historiography. I absorbed it too. I would have spoken exactly as you just have, really up until the last few years when I began to research the question and think more deeply about it. So I don't want to beat anybody over the head and say, look, you were obviously wrong. Yeah, I thought that too.
If we were to talk to any of these significant French thinkers, say, in the 18th century, I think that one of the premises of what you've been saying is that if one were to ask them what is going on intellectually and socially in your milieu, they wouldn't have the same answer. They would have different ideas of the context in which they live. Can you give us a range of the kind of things they might have answered? If you were to say to Diderot or to Voltaire or to an extremist like Horbach or Lemaître, who's an out-and-out atheist, what kind of answers would they have given if you'd asked them what's happening in the intellectual life?
Well, and everything you can possibly think of. France is a very sophisticated and advanced society. People are very well informed. They're talking about every subject under the sun that you can think of. And these subjects eventually end up in the Encyclopédie. They're talking about foreign affairs, they're talking about domestic politics, they're talking about trade and industry, they're talking about science, they're talking about the great divide between Jansenism and the Jesuits, anything you like, gossip, art, music, all these things. But there isn't one specially privileged group of subjects which are assembled together by Diderot and D'Alembert in the Encyclopédie, which can therefore be called the subject matter of the Enlightenment.
Going back to my previous point, though, would it not be fair to say that in as far as they coalesce at all, it is around an antipathy towards the political and intellectual hegemony of the Catholic Church in France? Isn't that a point of unity?
Well, there were religious sceptics at the time. There were anti-Catholics, and right at the end of the century, there are a few atheists. Do they actually coalesce? That's my point. Even in today's world, your enemies, especially, are the people in the same political party as yourself with whom you disagree. All the other people in the House of Commons, you get on fine with in the tea room, but it's the people you really disapprove of who are giving a different interpretation of what you claim to be a shared common inheritance. And it's like that, I think, in 18th century France too. Mm. So Christians are divided between Jansenists and Jesuits, and they fight it out. And it's a really, really big intellectual contest, just as much as the 16th century contests were.
I want to ask a little bit about the influence of England and Scotland within the intellectual debate, because certainly in the early part of the century, the influence of Locke and Newton is huge. Voltaire is a huge Anglophile and popularizes Newtonian and liberal thought on the continent. And retrospectively, people locate the origins of liberalism in this period. But you make the point that just in the same way as Enlightenment was everywhere, but the Enlightenment was nowhere, our concept of liberalism isn't to be found in these thinkers of the 18th century. What are 18th century thinkers thinking about, or what is Locke thinking about, and what influence does he have on the development of what would become one day liberalism?
I've argued elsewhere that liberalism is the proper name for a new ideology which is coined in England, at least, around about the year 1820, so that it's entirely improper to project it backwards into the 18th century and say that either the revolution of 1688 or the revolution of 1776 was caused by liberalism. Nobody talked at that time about liberalism. And certainly Newton has an influence in France, but he's also resisted because there's much attachment to the physics of Descartes. Locke is known about in France, but chiefly because of the theme of religious toleration. That's the theme they want to pick up from Locke. But Locke's politics are hardly known in France.
Right.
Because Locke speaks to a political world which is not shared in France. And it's also remarkable that really right up until the very eve of the outbreak of the American Revolution, Locke's politics are not dominant in the 13 colonies. It's a different world, it's a different society. They have different preoccupations. Mm-hmm. So the idea that there is one tide of ideas that sweeps from England or Scotland across the European continent is just a little bit overstated.
Again, this is a retrospective identification that simply wasn't there at the time.
When English thinkers in the early 19th century invent this new ideology, which comes to be called liberalism, they naturally reach back for a genealogy, antecedents, pioneers, who they claim launched the whole movement and prove, therefore, that they themselves in the early 19th century are carrying the authority of these figures. They're carrying forward the baton and implementing it, you know, the promise of those ideas. It's all bogus.
Isn't that a fundamental, a perennial human trait, really? Any new idea, whether or not it is new, we are inclined to reach back into history, to find antecedents, and to justify, to give it some authority, really. Aren't they doing something that basically every human ideology in history has always done?
Well, partly. I'm not an expert on every ideology in all of human history, but I can see that many people do try and do that. And so it's not new when the component ideologies of what we now call modernism try to do that for themselves. But they often do it much less than you might think. One thing I discovered when writing my book was that when socialism in Britain comes to be developed by British thinkers in the late 19th century, they don't reach back into the 18th century or the 17th century to create genealogies to any great extent. And certainly they don't hit upon something that they call the Enlightenment in order to claim that they represent the modern late 19th century instantiation of the Enlightenment. So yes, people do reach back, but that doesn't mean that it's a valid historical exercise. Historians have to show why this is part of the polemical activity of politics.
I want us to talk briefly about Germany. British audiences are less likely to know about German philosophy of the time, although the names Hegel and Kant will, I suspect, be very familiar. But it's in this context we often hear reference to an essay that Kant wrote in 1784, which you've already referred to, Was ist Aufklärung? This is almost always translated as what is enlightenment, and Aufklärung is seen as the closest thing as there was to a capital E enlightenment. Say a bit more about Aufklärung and that essay and what Kant was getting at there.
Certainly, yes. But can I make first a point about the German language and how it's translated into English? Karl Marx's famous book, Das Kapital, is not translated into English as the capital. It's translated as capital. And so die Aufklärung doesn't have to be translated into English as the Enlightenment with a leading capital E. It can just be translated as Enlightenment with a lowercase e. And indeed, when Kant's essay of 1784 is first translated into English in, I think, 1790s, it's translated as, under the English title, What is Enlightening, I-N-G, not What is Enlightenment, and still less, What is the Enlightenment? And if you look at Kant's essay in the original German and compare it with the best English translations, it's clear that Kant is not seeking to launch the Enlightenment any more than Martin Luther woke up one morning and said to himself, today I shall launch the Reformation. The Catholic Church in the 1400s into the early 1500s throughout Europe rings with demands for reform, reformatio, but nobody had reified the Reformation. And similarly, Kant, in his essay, is not saying there is a new intellectual and social movement called the Enlightenment, which I will now explain to you, and which I will now support, and which you must now support. On the contrary, he uses Aufklärung to mean, as everybody else meant at that time, a clearing up, an elucidation. And yes, he's thinking of major things, but he's not trying to say to people that this great new social movement, this intellectual movement, is delivering freedom to you. On the contrary, if you read the essay carefully, all that he is demanding is freedom for intellectuals like himself to debate major issues in scholarly publications. Everybody else in society, and this is the key word in this essay, everybody else has to obey. The key word in Kant's essay is obey. Soldiers have to obey their commanders. Taxpayers have to obey the tax collectors. Subjects have to obey the sovereign. He's fine with that. It's inevitable, he says.
So his famous opening sentence, enlightenment or enlightening, is the departure of the human being from its self-incurred minority. The point he's making there is with regard to intellectual freedom and the ability to question and not simply to obey certain intellectual authorities, right?
it's a phrase which is picked up in the 1960s when the youth culture really takes off and when teenagers really want to be emancipated and they have money in their pockets and they want the freedom to spend it in all sorts of ways. But it's a strange thing to say. It might apply in distant Königsberg, which is a very small and primitive society, but it doesn't apply to Western Europe as a whole. There, everybody is locked in controversy. Everybody is taking initiatives and doing things and indeed resisting authority. Maybe not in Königsberg were they resisting authority. All over the Western world, in France, in England, in Scotland, in Ireland, in the 13 colonies, people are already resisting and challenging authority. And they've been doing that not only for decades, but also for centuries. So we look back on Kant's essay of 1784 as the opening chapter of the Enlightenment, the beginning of a movement. But nobody at the time thought it was like that.
I want to come in a minute to the very important question of when the Enlightenment, as we now call it, did coalesce, when that definite article was inserted into this and when history was quarried for contemporary concerns. But before I do so, I do want to pick up on one of the issues we've talked a little bit about in our discussion so far, which is religion, which I think is very, very important indeed, partly because the polemicists with whom we started understand the Enlightenment as a movement against religion, against religious authority, against religious faith, and so on and so forth. But partly because, more importantly, as you've hinted at, religion is omnipresent in the 18th century. I wrote a book that came out last year looking at the history of science and religion, and it tracks the story right back from a couple of thousand years ago. But the chapter on the 18th century, or at least the first part of the 18th century, makes the point that in our popular imagination, this is the period when the antagonism between religion and science, anachronistic terms, but we'll leave it at that, was most tense, was most argumentative, was most bellicose. But in actual fact, from my reading of the texts, this is actually the period of time where they're most harmonious. In fact, they're too harmonious. They set up a fall for Darwinism 100 or so years later. You get hundreds and hundreds of texts looking at how you could read the existence and attributes of the deity from every single aspect of the natural world. So I think it's really important to emphasize, isn't it, that this period of quote-unquote the Enlightenment, of opposition to religion, is nothing like the case. There might be some French thinkers who are vigorously and angrily opposed to religious belief and authorities and so on and so forth, but it is not a phenomenon widespread throughout the 18th century, is it?
I entirely agree with that. I would add that there are really only two answers to all big historical questions. One, earlier than you thought, and two, later than you thought. And the antagonism between science and religion is emphatically later than you thought. And the emergence of notion of the Enlightenment, again, is later than you thought. It's true that since about the 1980s, historians have realized that far from being quickly secularized in the 18th century, both British society and continental European society were profoundly Christian for a very long time, and that intellectually it was extremely important to all of them, whether it was Locke or Hume or Rousseau or Voltaire or way into the French Revolution or long after the French Revolution. It was a much, much more theologically preoccupied society than it became in the 20th century, and especially in 20th century academe. And we have to think our way back into a very different mental universe if we're to appreciate the significance of that historical discovery.
Yes. You do make that point very well in the book. I mean, you talk about, well, you mentioned there, Locke, you've already mentioned Johnson, you write back Mary Wollstonecraft, you have a chapter on Richard Price and Joseph Priestley and Thomas Paine, all of whom were believers in some regard or other. Price was an Arian, Priestley a Socinian, Paine a deist. But the point is that theological concerns are central to their mental universe in a way that interpreters a century or two later often were simply not aware of, right?
Precisely. And in the 20th century, economics became so central to people's public professions that it drove out very often many other preoccupations of previous centuries. Maybe that is fading away. Perhaps the term the Industrial Revolution has now dropped out of prominence, even among professional historians. It's still there in the popular culture.
Well, it would be very interesting, and from my point of view, certainly rather encouraging if historians of the 21st century were more attuned to some of the theological and religious categories and concerns that dominate the thinking of the vast majority of thinkers right the way up until 1900 or possibly even beyond. Let me bring us into the 20th century and explore the very important question of when, how, and why all these disparate thinkers and concerns and strands of thought coalesced, or more accurately, I guess, were forced into a category that we now know as the Enlightenment. You write towards the end of the book that by the 1960s, the Enlightenment was securely established in academic usage. So what happened? How and why was the Enlightenment reified in that way?
It's a complex business, and I'm sorry I can't give you a very simple answer. But I think the one important contribution to it is German language histories of German philosophy in the 19th century. That sounds a bit abstract, a bit cerebral to English readers, but actually that is where it began, I think. It happened not instantly, not overnight, but slowly successive German historians of German language philosophy began to give more and more substance to the notion of Die Aufklärung. It was taken up and turned into the name for a period of time, and then it was given substance. And gradually, English language historians of German philosophy picked this up. But there weren't many of them in the English-speaking world. And Kant and then especially Hegel were great blanks on the map for many English philosophers and for the English public in general into the 20th century. So it was a slow, slow transfer of the term. And it really began, I think, in 1910, with the publication of a book by John Greer Hibben entitled The Philosophy of the Enlightenment. He was a professor at Princeton. Even then, when it's given that currency, it's not picked up quickly in England. And that's most remarkable because it shows that although the idea is available and feasible, it's not picked up and made to do a lot of work. So there are a number of strands running into this. One strand is that English language secularists began to reach back into the 18th century to find antecedents and pioneers among the English deists. The second contribution, which I just mentioned, is when English language historians of philosophy began to respond to the usage of German language historians of German philosophy. The third contribution, which I think is very important, is the contribution made by an enormously distinguished cohort of German Jewish intellectuals who are emigres from the Holocaust, from Nazi persecution. And they go primarily to the United States, but also to England, and they carry with them often what one might call a Kantian or a neo-Kantian approach in which the Aufklärung is rarefied and becomes the summary of all good things defined over and against Nazi horrors. And after 1945, German and Italian intellectuals at home want to repudiate fascism and Nazism, and they do so in part by reaching back into the culture of their country to depict what they claim is a much more noble and decent Germany or Italy. And then you get a number of US universities which set up courses in what they call Western civilization after the Second World War, primarily. And they produce textbooks. You don't get these in English universities in anything like the same way, but they're big business in the US. And these textbooks make use of big, broad generalizations, of which the Enlightenment is one. And then finally, I would add one last contributing notion, and that is the Cold War and the alleged confrontation between Soviet communism and what comes to be called the West. So what does the West stand for? A number of ways of explaining what the West stands for. One is the new invention of something called liberal democracy, which is still around. But the other is especially this new notion, the Enlightenment. And it does great service, therefore, in the Cold War and after. Mm-hmm. And then it's taken up by secularists like the ones we began this conversation by discussing. And it's put to other uses. They're not defending the West against communism. They are defending secularism and a pattern of life which is emancipated from the claims of Orthodox religion.
So that's very, very, very interesting, isn't it? The way in which, at least, say, from the middle of the 20th century, is this term with a definite article passes into our popular intellectual bloodstream. It's doing work right from the outset.
Yes, it is.
It is performing a function that is deemed relevant and significant to the contemporary political, social world. I just want to backtrack a little bit. I'm fascinated. Are you able to date the first time in which the definite article is inserted? Are you able to date when anybody starts talking about the Enlightenment? Is the book you mentioned, 1910, a kind of starting point, or does it go back earlier?
A little earlier. There are English language historians of German philosophy who begin to use the definite article when they're translating Kant. And that happens in the 1880s and 1890s. Mm. But they hardly realize what they're doing. They don't say, suddenly I've understood and I see that Kant was the pioneer of the Enlightenment. But gradually the definite article comes to slip in. And the real weight given to the Enlightenment doesn't come until much later than you think. Mm. And I would suggest it's not really until the 1960s.
Let me ask a slight devil's advocate question as we come into land, which is whether this is simply a matter of necessity, by which I mean this. I'm reminded of Peter Brown, a great historian of late antiquity, talking about micro-Christianities in late antiquity, in the sense that there are lots of different things that are going on in the 4th, 5th, 6th century that are best understood as localized phenomena rather than Christianity to court. In a similar way, people didn't think they were living through feudalism or the Renaissance or, as you mentioned earlier, the Reformation or the scientific revolution. In other words, we simply have to, post hoc, find identifiers to navigate, to understand and navigate our past or our understanding of the past. But ultimately, we have to talk about the Renaissance or the Reformation, and indeed the Enlightenment, even if those terms are, historically speaking, ultimately inadequate.
Can I suggest to you a parallel, which has only just recently occurred to me? Let us say, and I hope this never happens, that you were to develop half a dozen very serious medical conditions. You were treated by doctors for these conditions. You learned quite a bit about them. You were treated quite successfully for these conditions. But nevertheless, one day you felt so ill that you had to attend a major hospital's emergency department. You explained your symptoms to the staff on duty, and you explained what the diagnoses were that had been successfully treated in the past. And you found that the senior doctor on duty said, "No, no, you've misunderstood. You're not suffering from half a dozen serious ailments. You're suffering from one. You have a headache. I'm going to prescribe you some aspirin. Mm. Take the aspirin, go home, all will be well." Now, I asked, would that be an adequate diagnosis? And secondly, do you think the outcome would be a good one?
Certainly not.
So why should we have to use misleading notions? Do natural scientists go on talking about phlogiston?
Of course not. But I'll press you on this because I recognize and see the validity of those analogies, but we nonetheless find ourselves in need to speak in shorthand, I guess. Ideally, we would qualify at length the complexities of intellectual thought in the 18th century, or the various different forms of ritual and worship and theology in the churches in the 5th and 6th century. But we don't have time to do that most of the time, and we use effectively placeholders. And these terms, Renaissance, Enlightenment, Reformation, so on and so forth, are placeholders. And as long as we know they're placeholders, as it were, they come with an asterisk and a footnote by them, it's fine to use them.
But they will never come with a footnote explaining that they're inadequate. And if you were to put in such a footnote, the readers would ask, well, why use them at all? And indeed, I think that it's more serious than that, because ideas pass into popular discourse and they then mislead us fundamentally. For example, large numbers of states around the world call themselves people's republics or people's democracies.
Democratic people's republics.
And they're democratic republics, and they differ hugely. Some are bloodstained tyrannies. Others are stable and quite respectable states. But so long as they can get away with claiming to be instances of the common category, they get away with it. Because we don't probe, we don't ask, how do those polities actually work? So I think that far from being a practical convenience, they are a major practical inconvenience, indeed possibly worse than that.
I want to end where we started in talking about the present discourse around, quote-unquote, the Enlightenment. We talked earlier on about Steven Pinker and Anthony Pagden and Richard Dawkins. And before we came on air, we were having a brief conversation about Jonathan Israel, who's an American historian, who's written a series of monumentally large books on the Enlightenment, stretching from 1670 all the way up to The Enlightenment That Failed, the title of his fourth, which goes into the 1820s or so. He makes the argument that anything that's really important, and certainly important as far as today's values are concerned, are due to Spinoza. He wrote, the Enlightenment was one of the most important shifts in the history of man, not only attacked and severed the roots of traditional European culture in the sacred, magic, kingship and hierarchy, secularizing all institutions and ideas, but intellectually and to a degree in practice, effectively demolished all legitimation of monarchy, aristocracy, woman's subordination to man, ecclesiastical authority and slavery, replacing these with the principles of universality, equality, and democracy. That's pretty much in opposition to everything we've been talking about in our conversation. I'm genuinely interested to know how well that thesis has been received in the academy, and more generally what that says about the work that the Enlightenment is being called to do today.
I think a number of things are going on in the academy in reaction to Jonathan Israel. One is that there is still quite a lot of residual sympathy for all those emancipatory causes that you just read out. And indeed, who is going to be against peace and bread? But the other thing that's going on is a growing careful skepticism about whether Jonathan Israel's account of the Enlightenment stands up as an historical proof. And then we begin to think, well, have all these good things arrived? If only all these promises of his Enlightenment had arrived, would we not be living in utopia? Would we not be living in a peaceful world in which everybody was prosperous, everybody enjoyed good health, everybody was tolerant, intelligent, happy, satisfied? But of course, look around us. Is that the world in which we live? My first reaction when I began to be skeptical of the Enlightenment was to say, if only there had been such a movement, what a wonderful world we would live in today.
That would presumably suggest then that we can expect people to lean even further into the concept of the Enlightenment over coming years. Because if on the one hand people are seemingly happy with its reification, and yet also self-evidently the utopia that it promised has not arrived yet, the logical response for many people will be, well, we just need more of it then. We need more. We need to reappropriate, we need to defend, we need to push the Enlightenment all the more vigorously. So presumably, by that logic, we're just going to see a lot more of this triumphalizing, weaponizing the Enlightenment in the future.
I'm afraid we will. I think that prediction is exactly right. But will it work, is my question. There won't be a reconsideration overnight, but I suspect that there will over a decade or two, a growing realization that you don't achieve all these good things simply by waving the flag of the Enlightenment and by shouting more loudly about how wonderful a thing the Enlightenment was. It is actually much harder than we thought it was after the Second World War to frame and to implement reforming programs. It's not just a matter of saying we are on the side of history, or specifically, we are on the side of the Enlightenment. We carry forward the baton from these great Enlightenment figures. It doesn't actually work like that. It hasn't worked so far in Western history in recent decades, and I predict it won't go on working any better in future decades.
My passing question to guests on Reading Our Times takes us to the heart of what the podcast is about. The podcast is a podcast about books, about ideas, but ultimately about us. So my question is, what does what we've been talking about tell us about the human condition?
I think this takes us to the heart of my answer, that there is no one thing called the human condition. Why should there not be as many human conditions as there are human beings? Is that not why it is much harder to bring about utopia than it would be if there were one thing called the human condition?
The book is called The Enlightenment, An Idea and Its History. Jonathan Clarke, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Reading Our Times.
Thank you.
Next week, I'll be speaking to anthropologist Harvey Whitehouse about what we humans have inherited from our evolutionary past and how it shapes us today.
The whole idea of eliminating conformism, religiosity and tribalism is pie in the sky. It won't happen because this stuff will resurface because it's part of our natural way of thinking and behaving. So the real question is, how do we work intelligently with the grain of these biases to make them work for us rather than against us?
You've been listening to Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. It's produced by Phil Bodger. Our team includes Daniel Turner, Lizzie Harvey, and Chinny McDonald. Special thanks to Nina Humphreys, who composed our theme tune and all the music. You can subscribe to Reading Our Times on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And you can also find us on our website, theosthinktank.co.uk. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. It'll help other people find the podcast.